Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. For those who don't know me, my name is Larry Kramer. I'm the President and Vice Chancellor here at LSE. And it's my special, really, privilege and pleasure to welcome you all to this very special event. I'm delighted to see not just a full house, but it looks like mostly students, which I think is wonderful. The event tonight, just so you know, is jointly hosted by the LSE Department of Economics, the Center for Economic Performance, and the Center for Macroeconomics. So thank you to them for making this possible. I told Philippe I was going to keep the introduction short, and I will, because you want to hear from him and not me. That should not have gotten a laugh. All right. Economic growth. Economic growth is not a given, right? For most of human history, living standards did not change significantly from one generation to the next, and no one really expected them to do so. That began to change only with the advent of capitalism and the idea of a modern economy in the 18th century. But really radical change by historical standards really only began with the advent of the Second Industrial Revolution. And over the past century or so, economic growth has led to better standards of living around the globe. With all of its problems, there's been immense economic growth. Now, that growth has had a wide range of effects. It has driven down poverty and human misery. It's lengthened our lifetimes and our lifespans. It's shaped the course of war and peace. And it's dramatically altered the way our societies are organized and organize themselves politically. And that's just a few of the many effects that have resulted from all this economic growth. Now, behind that growth, then, has been one major driver, which is innovation. New ideas, new technologies, new ways of organizing economic activity, new ways to deliver goods and services. Those kinds of innovations have created economic activity that didn't exist before and prosperity that didn't exist before and where there was none. Now, understanding that process, then, is one of the greatest, most relevant, and most consequential intellectual puzzles of our world today. So our speaker tonight knows a little bit about that puzzle. And we're incredibly fortunate to have him at LSE and better still with us tonight to discuss these issues. Philippe Aguillon is professor of economics at LSE and the Collège de France and an associate of LSE's Center for Economic Performance. With Peter Howitt, he pioneered the so-called Schumpeterian growth paradigm, which was subsequently used to analyze the design of growth policies, the role of the state in the growth process, and the process by which new technologies come to market and make previous technologies obsolete. He's had a profound influence on the economics profession and is involved in policy debates on everything from inequality to taxation and artificial intelligence and on and on. Now, as you all know, in addition to being a member of pretty much every learned society that exists, Philippe, along with his collaborator, Peter Howitt, was awarded the 2025 Nobel Prize in Economics in recognition of his groundbreaking work on the process of creative destruction in the economy. Now, I know we're all looking forward to hearing more about that from him tonight, not from me. Now, there were, as you know, though, from me, quotes and press releases and letters from me and actually others at LSE in the frenzied days right after the announcement of the Nobel Prize. But as president of the school, I want to take this very public occasion simply to say how proud we are as a community of Philippe and his work. We all have come to LSE, and we all stay, because this is a very special place to learn and be part of helping to make our social, political, and economic world better. But what makes it special is the quality of the people who call it home. So all of your success is our success, and I want especially to thank Philippe for lending LSE his time and his good name and for sharing his life and his work with this community. And with that, it's my special pleasure to invite Philippe to the lectern.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for your very generous introduction, and it's wonderful to be at the LSE. LSE has been always home for me, and I owe enormous to LSE. I think without the LSE, I would not be here today, with the support I got from you over all the past years. And I will start. I'm always very intimidated at the beginning. So here is a picture of young Schumpeter, and Schumpeter had a very interesting life. He's been finance minister, he's been professor at Harvard, he's been Schumpeter is known to have coined the term creative destruction to name the process whereby new innovations displace old technologies. New innovations make old technologies obsolete. And so you can read Schumpeter, Capitalism, Socialism and Democracy, or other writings of Schumpeter, and he would spell out what he means by creative destruction. In fact, before reading Schumpeter, I never read enormous Schumpeter. I read some stuff of Schumpeter, but I read a lot Marx, actually, Das Kapital. And if you've read Marx, there is a kind of filiation between volume 3 and Schumpeter. And Schumpeter himself would acknowledge that. He would say, Marx is too good to be left to the Marxists. That's the way he would say it. But the notion of obsolescence is already, embryonic in volume 3 of Das Kapital. But Schumpeter made much more of it. The thing is that when I studied economics, in my student years, the leading model was the neoclassical Solow model. And Robert Solow is someone I interacted a lot with, and a wonderful man, and he pushed us a lot, actually. But the Solow model was a very elegant, and it's always I think you can't have any growth course without starting with Solow. Why? Because the Solow model is a very elegant and parsimonious model. It all revolves around two equations. The first equation would tell you how you produce output with a stock of capital, okay? And the second equation will tell you that how you accumulate capital. Well, you accumulate capital over time because you save part of your production to increase the capital stock. But so it's a very elegant model, but Solow himself, would show that under reasonable assumptions of decreasing returns to capital accumulation, that means I increase production much less if I move from 9 machines to 10 machines than if I move from 0 machine to 1 machine. But because I have these decreasing returns to capital accumulation, I cannot grow forever, based on capital accumulation. I run out of steam. If I just rely on capital accumulation and the savings to accumulate more capital, I run out of steam at some moment. So if you really want to explain long-run growth, and that's Solow, in fact, the Solow growth model that gave him the Nobel Prize in 1987 but was published in 1956, it's a model to show that, in fact, if you rely on capital accumulation alone, you cannot have long-run growth. You need something else, and the something else would be technical progress or the Solow residuals. In Solow model, you don't explain the technical progress. It's part of what you call the unexplained part of growth, which is the Solow residual. And of course, my obsession was to open the black box of the Solow residual. What is in there? What is there? What generates technical progress? And so, in fact, that's a kind of very interesting thing in life, is that I wanted to put imperfect competition in growth already in my statement, for when I applied for Harvard as a student in 1982. I knew that you had to, putting imperfect competition was important. And during my student years, I studied IO a lot with Dick Caves was the old school, but he was a very good teacher, Richard Caves. I don't know if you ever met Richard Caves. He was a very interesting person. And I learned a lot with Jean Tirole. And Jean Tirole was the theory of industrial organization. And that's really what I was really trained. I was fed up, I was spoon-fed with Tirole's theory of IO. And Schumpeter, would be a curiosity at the time. I think Dick Caves had his IO course, and you would talk about Schumpeter, but it was a curiosity. And so you would also hear about Schumpeter in a course on history of economic thought, but c'était une mondanité, quoi. You would hear about Schumpeter's creative destruction en passant, but you say, well, where is the model? There was no model. Where is the empirics? There was no empirics of that. There was some kind of ideas, some intuition, but it would not be mainstream at all. In the mainstream macro class, you would not have Schumpeter at all. And so something that happened to me was that I I came, you know, I joined MIT in 1987, my first year assistant professor, and I met, my neighbor was this guy, Peter Howitt. And it's very, very, it's very fortunate that I met Peter. In fact, you see, in life, sometimes failing can be quite important. My dream when I was a Harvard student was to enter the Harvard Society of Fellows, which is a kind of first, you know, first class postdoc. So I was shortlisted for oral exam for the Society of Fellows, and at dinner, in fact, Solow, it was funny, was a senior fellow of the Harvard Society of Fellows on top of being a MIT professor, and at dinner time he told me, look, you didn't quite understand the question that was asked to you, so I realized I had failed the test to become Harvard Society of Fellows. But thanks to which I joined MIT, which is not the worst fallback that can happen to you. Can be worse, quoi. And at MIT, I met Peter Howitt. So, in fact, you see, that was very funny. I just imagine, had I succeeded at the Harvard Society of Fellows, I would not be here today, probably. So sometimes failing can be quite quite useful. So with Peter, one day I entered his office. He was my neighbor. We used to talk a lot. And I said, Peter, why don't we, you are more macro. Peter had come to visit for a year from Canada, from Western Ontario. And Peter was working mainly on search and on employment. And he was there to work with Peter Diamond and Olivier Blanchard on search and unemployment. I think they were quite disappointed because at the end of the day, he didn't produce anything that year with Olivier Blanchard and Peter Diamond I know about. Instead, we worked together and we did our own growth model. So, and he was more macro and I was more the IO trained. I was more micro. And so we joined forces and we produced a new paradigm. And we said, look, why don't we write down from scratch a model, a growth model that encompasses the notion of creative destruction. Okay, so we wrote this model exactly during the time he was there. You know, we started to work together in December 87, and Peter had to leave in April. So we did all that in 4 months, actually, and then we refined. But the whole thing was done between November, December 87, and I would say April 88, and he had to leave back to Canada. And so the basic model revolved around three main ideas. The first idea is that long-run growth is driven by a cumulative process of innovation, where each innovator builds upon previous innovation. You always stand on giant shoulders. That's the first idea. Okay, the second idea is that innovations do not come from heaven. They result from entrepreneurial activities motivated by the prospect of innovation runs. If I innovate, I discover a new good or a cheaper way to produce or whatever, I get some runs for a while until I am superseded by new innovators. Okay, and the third idea is creative destruction. New innovations displace old technology. I need some water because I lose voice and I lose. Hold on, let me try this one. Voilà. Yeah, it's very funny because you can. Yeah. Okay. Oh, that's right. I realized that there was another glass here. Ah. Okay. Good. Good for me. Alors now, what's interesting in this model is that at the heart of the paradigm, there is a contradiction. On the one hand, you need the innovation runs to motivate innovation investments, okay? But on the other hand, yesterday's innovators are tempted to use their runs to prevent subsequent innovations because they don't want themselves to be subject to creative destruction. And regulating a market economy is largely about how to manage this contradiction. You want to give runs, you want to let new innovators, new talents to set up firms, to grow their firm, to become, you know, to be rewarded for what they do. But you want to make sure that once they become big and they have rents and they have a big firm, whatever, they don't use that to prevent new generations of innovators. So really, a fast-growing economy, if you take the Schumpeterian view, it's an economy where all the time you have new talents coming in. They need to have the possibility to innovate, to establish new activities, to grow them if they are good. And you want to create an environment that would allow them to do that. But you want to make sure that once they've grown, they won't prevent subsequent generations of talents to come in and grow in turn. You see, I mean, that's the world you are talking about. So one thing I would like to show is that also it's a model that, you know, accommodates firm dynamics very naturally. And this extension here is due to Clete and Kortum, a very, very major extension of our basic framework. Here I represent a firm with four lines, okay? And here that tells you how well you do on each of the line, the A. So for example, this firm is particularly good at this production activity. How you expand? You expand because I would do creative destruction on another line. There will be another line here, and firm F would improve upon what's currently done on that line. Firm F would displace the current innovator, and then firm F would grow into becoming a five-line activity. How do you shrink in this model? Is that someone else innovate upon one of firm's lines, for example, this one. Firm F will lose this activity, and firm F becomes a three-line. How you enter in this model? You are nobody. You are not there. You are a potential entrant. You innovate upon one line, you become a one-line firm. How you exit? You are one-line firm. Someone innovates upon you. You exit the market. So you see, very naturally, the creative destruction paradigm accommodates firm dynamics. And firm dynamics is very important. Where economies that grow fast are economies where talents can come in and they can grow. And but they don't grow in a way that would prevent newcomers. Well, that's the idea. Now, there are distinctive predictions of the theory. A first prediction is that growth is positively correlated with turnover. A fast-growing economy, it's an economy where you have all the time new talents challenging existing firms, you see, and force them either to innovate themselves if they want to escape competition with the newcomer, or to disappear and just, you know, let the newcomer take over. That's a fast-growing economy. And you can represent, you know, cross-country or cross-regions. You could on the horizontal axis, you could put what destruction. You can measure creative destruction by the entry rate of new firms. You can measure it by churning, firm exit, firm entry together, your job creation plus job destruction. You have various ways to measure the turnover rate, you see. And usually regions or countries which displace higher rate of creative destruction measures by any of those measures will be places where per capita GDP growth is higher. So that's a prediction which is an important one, which no previous models of growth would generate. You see what I mean? And so that's the first idea, which is, I think, an important idea. Another idea is that, very much due to work by our friend Pete Klino and Chiang Tai-sei, and looking at the relationship between firm age and firm size, you see that usually they tend to be positively correlated. In the description I gave before, I said when you enter as a one-line firm, and then you grow, and you may shrink, but in expected terms, there is a positive correlation between firm age and firm size. And that's what they find. I mean, they find, it's very interesting, it's steeper in the U.S. than in Mexico and India. I don't know where France would lie, U.K., I would not know. But UK would be closer to US than France is, I guess. But why is it that it's a steeper relationship between firm age and firm size in the US? Because probably when you are a good innovator in the US, you get financing. You have access to venture capital, to institutional investment, you know, pension funds, mutual funds. That allows you to grow. And it means also that if you survive, you are good. I mean, you see, I mean, if you're not that good, someone better will have found the way to grow at your expense. So it's both the fact that in the US you have these good innovators have access to funding and they can grow more, and also it's because of that they will tend to displace less performing innovators. So if you survive long enough, it might mean that there is a selection effect operating. That might mean that you're also better and therefore more prone to grow more. And that's why presumably you have the steeper line in the US. Okay? I think that's a very important prediction of the paradigm. Another prediction is on competition. I always tell the same story. I said you are a classroom, you are all equally good. And suppose you have the top of the class and the bottom of the class, and so you have the top performers and the less and the lagging part of the class, and I open the door and I let a very good element into the class. What will happen? The top of the class will work harder to remain the top of the class, whereas the bottom half of the class, they're already discouraged, they will be even more discouraged once I bring the new new good element. Firms react the same way. The blue line represents firms that are close to the technological frontier in their sector. There are those who are close to the best practice, as Nelson and Phelps would call it, in their sector. And they react to more competition, more entry, or whatever how you measure competition, by innovating more and growing more. The orange firms are firms that are far below the technological frontier in their sector. They react negatively to more competition. They tend to be discouraged by competition. And of course, the more developed a country is, the more blue firms there are in these countries compared to orange firms. You see, the higher the fraction of blue firms. So that already also tells you that the more developed a country is, the more growth enhancing it would be on average to have more competition on the product market. Okay, so competition is typically something that will tend to be increasingly more growth enhancing the more developed a country. Okay, so that's alors now if you want to say what is the overall relationship, what we show is that it's an inverted U. If you aggregate, you see, at the aggregate level of the economy, for low level of competition, overall, more competition is the escape competition effect that will dominate at low level of competition. So you have an upward sloping part. But if you already start from high level of competition, it will tend to be the discouragement effect that tends to dominate. And you have this inverted U curve. Okay, so what I would like to do now is to, now I start the lecture. In fact, how long do I have? 40 minutes? No. That was an introduction. I would like to do three main things. I would like to revisit two main enigma in economic history. I would like to rethink the future of capitalism. And I would like to shed light on the AI revolution. So some historical enigma. Let me just focus on two enigma, secular stagnation and the middle income trap. So secular stagnation, it's this enigma. If you look at the average yearly rate of TFP growth in the US, you see that you had a growth upsurge between 1995 and then you had a growth decline, okay? And you want to understand why you had this decline in productivity growth in the US, but also in other countries. And you can see that this upsurge followed by growth decline is particularly strong in IT producing sectors, the black line, and in IT using sector, the gray line. So it seems to have something to do with IT, okay? Another thing is that during the time where you have the growth upsurge, you can, and that's the work of John von Rienen and co-authors, you see that there has been an accelerated rise in concentration. Here I show services, but it's also in manufacturing and other. So at the time where you had this growth soaring up in the US, you also had concentration soaring up, okay? So that's something you want to understand. Okay, the share of, here it shows the share of sales of the four biggest firms in the US, this blue curve, or the share of the 20 biggest firms, okay, and you have the equivalent, with employment, okay, which are the triangle one. So whether you measure by sales or by employment, you have an accelerated increase in concentration during the years where that growth took off in the US, the 95-2005. Another thing, if you look at markups, you see that the average markup goes up, but not so much because within firms it goes up. The within firm markup is the blue line. There is no upward trend in the blue line. It's really a composition effect, which is the black curve, and that's due to work by Dolocker, Eckhout, and Unger, but Bakae and Farr had very similar findings, and so it's really the story that you had. It's not so much because within firm markup would have gone up; it's because high markup firms, which were the superstar firms that became prominent, which we see the rising concentration. You had with the IT revolution, you had the rise in superstar firms, and those superstar firms were high markup firms, and because they became more pervasive, the average markup went up. It's a composition effect, not within firm that the markup went out so much. It's really that you had this superstar firm. And also, what's very interesting, you can see this phenomenon of the big firms becoming much bigger. If you look at the rising establishments per firm, you see that it is those firms with more than 10,000 employees that increase most their number of establishments. So you could have thought, you know, that once you've reached a certain size, you run into decreasing returns, and it should be the small firms that increases more the number of establishments. And you don't see that. You see indeed instead that it's the large firm that, you know, expand the most. And so the story is that, you know, with the IT revolution, you had the rise of superstar firms in the US, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Walmart. Those firms knew how to harness the power of IT better than other firms, and they started to expand more and more establishments, merger and acquisitions unboundedly, and they ended up becoming pervasive. And because they became pervasive, at the end of the day, they ended up discouraging entry of new firms. And here you see the entry rate of new firms, and you see that the entry rate of new firms has fallen. So it's really a Schumpeterian story. Those firms innovated, they knew how to harness IT, and they expanded. Initially, they boosted the growth process in the US, but they expanded so much that they ended up becoming tentacular and discouraging entry of new firms. And that's what caused the decline in productivity growth in the US eventually. So it's very much a Schumpeterian phenomenon. You let firms grow, but they grow so much unbundledly that they end up discouraging entry of new firms. There's been another insight explanation for the decline. The one I presented is very much work I did with Timo Bopart, Antonin Bergeau, Pete Clino, and Yui Li, which is in the River Economic Studies. Another parallel work was done by Axigit and Attes. And their view is that you have a world with leaders and followers. In each sector, you have a leader and a follower. And what happened, their explanation is that the leaders made it harder for the followers to catch up with them. So what happened is that the technological gap between leaders and followers widened up, and therefore what happened then, and you can see that the technology gap you see in 1980 is much lower than the distribution of technology gaps across sectors, and you see that the distribution is moving to the right. So the gap between leaders and followers has increased, and that had a double consequence. It had the consequence that the follower would be discouraged because they say, oh my God, I can't catch up anymore. Okay, and so they would not do as much, the follower, to try and catch up. And the leader would feel that they can have tranquil life because they are not challenged anymore by followers, and they would do less as well. And that would be their view of the decline. You see, it's again a Schumpeterian story, but with leaders and followers. Okay, and with their story, he would say, well, the entry is discouraged of new firms or innovation by laggers or entry, but also because the leaders are so much ahead of the followers, you have market concentration going up. So they get at the same phenomenon as we do, but you know, taking this leader-follower approach. Okay. Okay, so that's the secular stagnation. And just to say that the Schumpeterian world, and what's interesting with the secular stagnation is that there is a whole debate there. Some people believe that, you know, it's just because ideas are harder to find. And I have my colleagues, Chad Jones and other co-authors, they're all my co-authors, and they wrote this beautiful paper on how the ideas harder to find. And we have this debate with Bob Gordon on that. My view is that ideas are harder to find within each field, but not overall. For example, in economics. In economics, within each field, you've seen general equilibrium theory moving up and then falling down. You've seen game theory doing this, contract theory doing this, creative destruction. I don't know where we are. Huh? But I always say, you know, what's great with creative destruction, the day I become obsolete, it validates the theory. That's the advantage we have on other... that's the insurance policy we took. Voilà. My view is that ideas are harder to find in any particular field, but I think we have an innovation reset all the time. We keep finding new ideas and new topics, and that's why we keep innovating. And of course, with AI, it will be even more the case, but even without AI, I believe very much that, you know, Gordon might be right within topics, and I think I'm more on the Mokir side, you know, when I include the reset, the fact that you have all the time new. We saw that with technological revolution. You had the steam engine, then you had the electricity and the combustion engine, then you have the IT, now you have the AI. You run into decreasing returns on each, but then you have new revolutions coming in. We see that at a big level, but it's true more at the more micro. Okay, so that's one explanation. I believe much more in the explanation that you had the IT revolution, some firms became superstars, and they ended up discouraging. Why is it more optimistic? Because if it's just ideas harder to find, fine. There is nothing you can do there. If it's something like this, you could say, well, competition policy could help you. Maybe the problem was there is that we let those firms become too large. We did not adapt competition policy to the IT revolution. And that's a view that, for example, Richard Gilbert or others have defended. And that's much more optimistic because we know there's something to do there. It's not like this hopeless. Well, otherwise, you have the view there is nothing you can do against growth decline. Okay, I want to talk about the middle income trap, but if that will make me talk about Europe and US. So here is the Soviet Union. Alors, I have to tell you that in my youth, I was a Communist Party member. Well, I have to say, maybe you want all to leave the room. That's the fact. Well, I had a communist father that helps, of course. He had some influence. It's a whole history. But at the time, up to the 70s, I think we wanted to ignore a number of things that were not quite right in the Soviet Union. But there was a view saying, well, you know, after all, well, it's not the kind of organization or society we would love to have. But look, it's quite working pretty well. They grow, and it's true that up to 1975, you would see that, you know, per capita GDP of the Soviet Union seems to be growing even possibly faster than in the US. Quoi. So there was the view saying, it's another system. De Gaulle, other people would say, it's another system, but it works. They have their own way to do things, and it works. But you see that starting in 75, growth tapers off in Soviet Union. That could be the solo model. It could be that a lot of it was capital accumulation and they run out of steam. Could be another explanation. They grew through imitation a lot, not entirely. They invented as well, but you run out of steam with imitation, okay? So that's the Soviet Union story. And the story we developed, and that's very much based on work with Daron Acemoglu and Fabrizio Zilibotti, and I have to tell you that where did I meet them? I met them here at LSE, because in 91, I was at EBRD, was my first year at EBRD, and I was asked to teach a topics class at LSE, and in my class, I had Acemoglu, Zilibotti, and Piketty. Voilà, and that's where I met them, voilà. And so it was 91. And it has a very interesting story. That's why I smuggled Daron through the Canadian-US border, but I won't tell you how I did that. Maybe I should not, It's true that these days I should not say these kind of things because I may not be able to make it to my next trip to the US. Whoa, okay. So here you see the idea there is that 80 is the country's productivity today, and 80 plus 1 is the country productivity tomorrow. There are two ways to grow. Either I can imitate the technological frontier, 80 bar. For example, I try to catch up with the US, which is a country with the highest, TFP or labor productivity. One way to grow is through imitation. That's the mu M. Another way to grow is to innovate upon yourself, to go from A to gamma A, where gamma is greater than 1. When you are very far below the frontier, the main source of growth is imitation plus capital accumulation. Leave it aside. So that's why you would grow. But when you get sufficiently close to the frontier, increasingly, frontier innovation becomes an engine of growth. So if you want to talk about China, for example, you could say that China, between 1978, Deng Xiaoping, and some recent time, they were growing a lot through imitation. Technology transfers, factory reallocation, improved management practices, all this was good from UM, and they grew a lot from UM. But increasingly, some people thought that China would never make it to go from going to, from to imitation into growing through frontier innovation, but they become increasingly frontier innovation. Robin can tell you, Robin is here, he knows much, but your recent paper, it speaks to that. Okay. So, but the thing is that what is the problem of the middle income trap is that some countries use the institutions and policies that are mu M enhancing, that are imitation enhancing, are not the same policies and institutions as those that are frontier innovation enhancing. For example, we've seen before that competition was important when you are in the business of frontier innovation. It may not be a big deal not to have competition when you are in the business of just imitating, okay? And there are other policies. And I will get to those. And the problem is that during the imitation phase, you have the emergence of superstar firms, again, big firms, conglomerates, and they may oppose the transition from policies that are good for UM to policies that are good for UN. So, for example, an example is Korea, South Korea. Okay, now, of course, North Korea, you would have the flat electrocardiogram, except in weaponry. Bon. Okay, so here is the per capita GDP growth rate post-Korean War. So, of course, it's very high, and then it goes down. Or it could go down because, of course, as you get closer to the world frontier, you grow less and less by imitation, okay? But something else happened in Korea, is that in Korea, during the imitation phase, you had the emergence of large conglomerates called the chaebols. I never know how to pronounce. There are people from Korea, they would correct me. I'm sure I don't pronounce it correctly. The chaebols, and those were big conglomerates. And those conglomerates, not only they discourage entry of non-chaebol firms, but they would also prevent transition from policy to more competition. You see, for example, they would oppose. We know that if you are in the business of frontier innovation, it becomes crucial to have competition policy. But the chaebols, they don't want competition policy because they benefit from having no competition. So the problem is in countries like Korea is that you have, during the imitation phase, you have the emergence of large firms that oppose the necessary transition from MUM enhancing to MUN enhancing, in particular, product market competition. You see what I mean? And then you fall into a middle income trap, which is the subject of the World Development Report of last year. It's middle income trap. So it's entirely based on this. Japan is not a middle income country, but it faced a similar problem. You see, you had very fast growth in Japan up to the 1990s, and then growth slowed down, essentially stopped. And there, you have a similar story. You have the Keiretsus. The large conglomerates in Japan are the Keiretsus. They grew very large, and not only they discourage entry of non-Keiretsus, but they also, there are good reasons to believe that they successfully opposed moving towards more trade liberalization and more competition in Japan, which explains why Japan has not made the transition fully from imitation-based to frontier innovation-based. And so that's Japan. And now we come to Europe, okay? Because it's easy to criticize others and not look at your own problems. Okay, here we are. So here, it represents, that's very much due to my friend Antonin Bergeau, who is also spends time at CEP and POID, and is with me, he's at HEC, but he's also with me at college, in the lab in Paris. So here, this represents the per capita GDP of the euro area since 1890. And we put at one the U.S. Per capita GDP. So it's really the ratio of the Eurozone per capita GDP over the US per capita GDP. Okay? And you see, of course, that here is the Second World War. That's obvious, Second World War. You destroy capital in Europe, and we did not innovate much, obviously. But then you see that between 1945 and the mid-80s, we catch up with the per capita GDP, partly of the US. But you see, since the mid-80s, we decline again. And, you know, I have to tell you that you should visit a very interesting country called France, where when you don't like some things, you pretend it doesn't exist. Alors sometimes you ask some economists from some other Nobel Prize or whatever to come to help you and explain there is no European decline. So, believe it or not, I've been subject for the past month to papers by renowned colleagues explaining there is no European decline. This is absurd. There is absolutely a European decline. This is, you know, when you don't like the, you know, when you have a flu, you just break the, you know, the thermometer, okay? very interesting, no? It's interesting. But, if I tell you how they do, you would be quite amused. You'd be quite amused. Okay, so there is a decline. Okay, and the decline, you can see it also with innovation. That's again due to Bergeau. If you look at high-tech patents, you can see the US are there. You can see China emerging, and you see Europe declining. And of course, when I show this picture in China, of course, they love it, obviously. Huh? When I show it in Europe, they love it less, obviously. And voilà. So really what happened, and you see what's very interesting also is that the drama So the problem in Europe is that we failed. You see, up to the story is very much a middle-income trap. Our growth between 1945 and 1985 was very much, we rebuilt our capital stock, maybe thanks to the Marshall Plan didn't harm, and we also imitated. You see, they had their technological revolution, the second industrial revolution, electricity, combustion engine. We were catching up with them. We had a good education, good schools in Europe that helped catch up with the second industrial revolution. So that was very much the but then what happened, you had the IT revolution. And the US, they moved into it, of course, fully, and we did not fully move into it. And if you look at high tech, they went into high tech, and we remain mid-tech incremental. They went into high-tech breakthrough innovation, and we remain mid-tech incremental in Europe. And the drama, why is it a drama? Because if you look at, again, that's Bergeau, if you look at the origin of ideas of patents in disruptive technology, you see here I list some of them, additive manufacturing, blockchain, computer vision, genome, you see that, you know, of course, it relies a lot on papers written in the US, but it relies a lot on papers written in Europe. And you see, so in Europe, despite the fact research is underfunded in Europe, we produce lots of basic papers that are used to that are really fueling, you know, breakthrough innovations. But the innovations are not done in Europe; they are done elsewhere, in the U.S. or now in China, not in Europe. Okay, that's what the sad part. Okay, and another thing which is also very interesting: if you look at the top patenting firms in the U.S. Today versus 25 years ago, 2023 versus 2000, is now not the same firms. There are new firms. If you look at the top patenters in Europe, they are the same. It's the same old guys. So it's really Schumpeterian, you know. In the US, you have creative destruction. You have new firms coming in. In Europe, you have the same incumbents, boom, boom, you know, and not and stuck in mid-tech incremental, quoi, and no way to enter the market or to, voilà. And that's really the drama, the European drama. Over the past 20 years, patenting and R&D investment in the US moved from mid-tech towards high-tech, not in Europe. And I think that's, I think, a telling story, and that illustrates the idea of creative destruction. Where you have growth is where you have creative destruction. Well, the leading firms today are not the same as the leading firms 25 years ago. Okay. So so now why is that important? Because what do you do about it? And that's where Mario Draghi comes in. And other people, you know, there were three reports. The Italians are extremely good producing the wonderful report. You have the Draghi, the Letta, and the Bocconi school report. And they say, well, you know what you're lacking in Europe? You're lacking first a single market. I told you competition is important. But in Europe, you don't have full competition because you have, you had Brexit in the UK. But, you know, even without Brexit, we don't have a single market. Because in fact, you have the practice of gold plating. Each European country has its own regulations to EU regulations. So we don't have a single market for goods and services, let alone for capital. Okay? We don't have. So it means that we have less rents to successful innovators and less competition because we don't have a single market. So we have to achieve a single market. But there is, of course, political economy there. Okay? So number one. Number two, we don't have, you know, to break through innovation, you need to fail. You remember I told you I failed the Society of Fellows. Failure is so important. I encourage you to fail. In the U.S., the U.S. that I remember, I may fail to enter to pass customs. That failure, I don't know if it's so good. But the failure is important. Is that in the U.S., my feeling is that when you fail, people tell you, well, that's great. If you fail, is that you tried. In my country, Europe, when you fail, they would put you a donkey bonnet d'âne, quoi. They would, really, you would feel very stupid. You didn't dare because failing was really horrible. And I think it's very important to fail. For example, long-term research funding is so important, and they have a lot of that in the U.S., because it allows you to fail. When you have long-term research funding, you can take risk and fail. For small startups, venture capital, you know, it's a way to allow firms to fail, because they say, well, I'm there with you, you can fail, but I'm with you for a while. And for large firms, and that's the work I did with Zingales, with Luigi Zingales and John Van Rienen on institutional investors, what we found out is that they do that for large firms. Manager of large firms may be reluctant to take risk. It's very much the managerial incentive story of Bengt Holmström. But what happens when you have internal investors, they encourage managers of large firms to also take risk and fail. And you see, whenever you have institutional investment involvement, but there is much less firing of managers following bad news in larger firms, in CompuStat firms. So in the US, they have an ecosystem that encourages risk-taking and failure. And we have much less of that in Europe. Then, long-term research funding, we don't have much. Venture capital, underdeveloped. So in the UK, it's better than others, but in the rest of Europe, we don't. Institutional investors, we don't have. And so we don't have, you see, the ecosystem that would favor risk-taking and going to. So it's really single market, long-term research funding, the financial ecosystem, the DARPA. I don't want to go into the Defense Advanced Project Agency. We would be great to do one between France and the UK on defense and AI, I think would be wonderful. We don't have anything approaching DARPA in Europe, which is a way also to reconcile industrial policy and competition policy. It's a whole ecosystem that will make you do breakthrough innovation, and we don't have it in Europe. And they have it in China now, and they have it a lot in the US. I made a joke, by the way, in the US. With that joke, I think it was very bad. Because there was an NBER meeting last year. And they had a session on innovation policy. And they were looking at second-order innovation policy, how they could improve. I don't know, Mark, you were there, maybe. And you remember I made that joke. I said, you know, in fact, some people in the US, they read the Draghi report. They felt so bad for the Europeans. They say, you know, what we'll do, since they're unable to get their acts together and catch up this way, we will do our job, we will catch up this way, and we will undo all the policies. We will look carefully at the Draghi. The research funding, bah, boom. We will undo IRA, boom. We will undo the things that they say we should emulate. So that, in fact, we should be grateful, you see. They really tried to implement the Draghi report in reverse. Alors, that joke, everybody was laughing, except, voilà, not everybody, actually. Voilà. Yeah, I think I'm in bad shape for the customs. Okay, good. So let me talk about rethinking capitalism. How long do I have? Minus how many minutes?
Yeah. Long as you want.
Oh my God, that's a very bad sign. It means I don't worry over time. Okay. So, because I want to say a few words about AI as well. The US, and I say lots of good things about the US, but I want to say also good things about Europe. It's true that the US does poorly on inequality and social protection, but the US, Europe does poorly on innovation, as I already illustrated. If you look at the Gini index, which measure global inequality, the global departure from perfect equality, US is above Sweden, Scandinavians, France, Germany, and others. If you look at poverty rate, US is above. But the more, worrisome part is the Anne Case Angus Deaton that you all know is the death of despair. What our friends Anne Case and Angus Deaton showed in the recent work was they look at the death rate of unskilled middle-aged workers in the US. And what they showed is that the death rate went up recently, whereas in Germany and France it went down. UK is a bit going up a bit, but much less than in the US. And they link it to, job insecurity. They say when you face job insecurity in the US, you're afraid to lose, access to health services or status. And what you do is that you start taking opioids, sleeping pills, And as a result, the death rate goes up, and stress goes up. And that's the thing. But on the other hand, so the social system in the US, you may argue, but when it comes to innovation, they are doing much better than we are. If I just show one more figure saying how much, the US dominate everybody else when it comes to innovation. If you look at the flow of triadic patents, which are patents registered in the US Patent Office, the European Patent Office, and Japanese Patent Office, it's a way to measure good quality patents. The flow per million inhabitants of triadic patents in the US is much higher than elsewhere. So you see the thing, you could say, why not try to combine the good side of the American model of market economy, which is to be very highly innovative, with what you could perceive as a good side of a European model. There is not a single European model, but you could say in Europe, which is to be maybe more inclusive and protective. And some people believe it's an either or. If you choose to be more innovative, it should be at the expense of being more inclusive and protective. But I would like to point to at least three policies that could make you more innovative and more protective or inclusive. The first one is flex security on the labor market. I told you about the death of despair in the US. But in Denmark, they have a fantastic system called Flex Security. When you lose your job in Denmark, for 2 years, you get 80 or 90% of your salary, up to a certain level of salary, of course, and the state retrains you and helps you find a new job. And if you refuse more than 2 jobs in your qualification, then the unemployment subsidy goes down. That's the system they put in place. Well, they might have a change over time, but that's the Flex Security system. And I have my colleague, Alexandra Roulet, who from INSEAD, and she... What she did, and also at the college, what she did is to look at the effects on health of losing your job in Denmark, to contrast with Anke Zengus-Ditton. And she compared the evolution of health indicators for a worker who loses her job, whose firm closes down in Denmark, to an identical worker in age, education, and experience in a firm that does not close down. So that's a way to be exogenously, I lose my job. And so it's a diff in diff. I look before and after. I compare between the treatment group, which are those who lose their job, and the treatment group, and the control group, those who don't, before and after the job is lost. And what you see is that there is no effect of losing your job in Denmark on purchase of antidepressants, opioids, or whatever, unlike in the US. There is no effect on probability to visit hospital for circulatory problem and effect on mortality either. So they showed they have a system. And what's interesting with the Flex Security system is that it made creative destruction work much better. So it made the Danish economy more innovative because firms can hire and lay off more easily. And when a worker is laid off, she is being retrained and bounces back into the labor market. So it makes creative destruction work much better. But it also was done while being protective. You see, so Flex Security, I think, is very important. I mentioned Flex Security because with AI, people are very fearful of mass job destruction, but there will be also job creation. How you go over that? And I think more than ever, you have to take very seriously the Flex Security and see how you would adapt. Denmark is a small country. How could I adapt? You know, Flex Security, how could I do it in China or in bigger countries? And I think that will become increasingly important in the debate, the Flex Security. Another one is education. That's very much based on the work that our colleague Xavier Jaravel has done with John Van Rynen and co-authors Bell, Chetty, Petkova. So what they did in a beautiful paper published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, they look at the probability of inventing as a function of your parental income. And what they show is that you are much more likely to innovate if your parents are in the top centiles of the income distribution. So you have this J curve. So that's on recent data. The Axigit, Grigsby, Nicholas have shown the same J curve with historical US data. And in joint work with Axigit, Haitinen, and Toivanen, we looked at Finland, and we also found a J-curve. And I was very surprised, because I said, that's strange, because Finland, education is free in Finland. And they have very good PISA tests. It's a very highly performing education system. Unlike Sweden, they screwed up the system a bit, and France, oh my God, it's terrible. But, it used to be okay, but I speak under Camille... Camille Terrier's control there. We used to have a good education system in France, jadis. You see what's very strange, that in Finland, you have a J-curve despite the fact that you have a very high quality, good PISA test, and free, totally free from kindergarten to university. It's totally free. How come you get a J-curve? And then we realize that in fact is because the higher earning parents are also more educated parents, and therefore they transmit knowledge and aspirations to their children. So it's not so much that they pay more, it's that they transmit knowledge and aspiration. And if you control for parental education, the curve flattens out. It goes from the blue curve to the red curve. So that's part of the explanation. But it doesn't explain fully, because if the school was so good in Finland, parental knowledge should not matter so much. So you should have a flat anyway. But in fact, what happened in Finland is that you had a reform in 1970. It's in 1970 that education became broad-based. And here I'm comparing the probability of inventing of a child with a parent income in the various brackets. I compare is the ratio of the probability of inventing of a child that goes to school after the reform divided by the probability of inventing of a child with same parental income but we went to school before the reform. And what you see is that the reform lifted the probability of inventing for children in that bracket. That's what's very interesting. Why is that interesting? Because, in fact, we suffer from a phenomenon that, you know, Jaravel and John call lost Einsteins. We have many lost Einsteins in our country. We have many, or lost Marie Curie, because we have many very smart kids born to poor backgrounds, and the parents cannot transmit knowledge and aspiration to them. And as a result, we lose them as innovators. You do a reform like in Finland, you will boost innovation because you will reduce the number of lost Einsteins. Many more people can become innovators, but at the same time, you have inclusive growth because more people can become innovators. So education is also something that makes you more innovative and more inclusive. And the last one is competition. I told you about the decline in productivity growth in the US, and I told you it had a lot to do with the superstar firms, that the competition policy in the US did not adapt, did not prevent firms from becoming pervasive and tentacular, you know, hegemonic, and that ended up discouraging entry. Suppose now you change competition policy, you are much more stringent on data sharing. If you see that instead of looking just at market share, and market definition, you look at whether or not a merger and acquisition will discourage future entry or not. And if you see that it discourages future entry, you undo the merger. You see that's a much more dynamic way to do competition. If you do something like this, what will happen in the US? You will have more new entry of innovators. So that will boost innovation. But the thing also is that it will boost social mobility, because in recent work I've done with Axigit, Bergeau, Blandel, and Emus in the Review of Economic Studies, we showed that entrant innovation boosts social mobility. Why? Because entrant innovation means more creative destruction. But the creative destruction means that you have people who replace others. That's social mobility. And what we showed is that creative destruction is a big driver of social mobility. So if we reform competition policy to let more entry, to let more entrants in the US, you will boost growth because you will have more innovators, but you also boost social mobility. So you see, those policies are important. Now, I think I'm almost done, because I think you are dead. I wanted to say just a few words about AI. Should we fear AI? Okay, so in joint work with Chad Jones and Ben Jones, I was the only non-Jones in the team, so I get a sense why the minority, but they treated me very well. They was very well. I was. We argued that AI should boost productivity growth because it will automate tasks, not only in the production of goods and services, but also in the production of ideas. It's much easier with AI to recombine old ideas and create new ideas. Okay, so we believe it has high growth potential. And if you just look at growth automating tasks, or there I had a big debate with Darren. Darren thought that it would you would not. At most, from just automating tasks in the production of goods and services, you could expect only an extra 0.7 percentage point per year of growth. You see, if you grow at 1%, you would grow at 1.07. But in joint work with Simon Bunel, and I won't go into the detail, we argued that, in fact, it's 10 times more than what Darren got. So we think it's very much in the same ballpark as IT. And just looking at AI automating tasks in the production of goods and services, here I'm not even taking into account the fact that AI automates tasks in the production of ideas. Okay? So in fact, you see, what we see, if we do just automating tasks in the production of goods and services for 10 years per year, you would have an extra 0.7 percentage point, and then you go back to the growth rate you had before. That's the dotted line is without AI. But in fact, the truth is the blue line, because you have this extra growth from the fact you automate production of ideas. And that's permanent, because you make innovation technology permanently better. We know that. Many people, I have colleagues who write papers now, the proof is made by the ChatGPT. You go faster, you can check, but instead of taking 1 week to prove a theorem, they take 1 day or 2 days. Okay, so we don't know yet how to quantify going from there to there. So it has enormous potential, but I wanted to say, what is the problem there? It's institutional, and that's why I'm very much also in line with Joel Mokyr. I was so happy to share the prize with him, because we think alike, we think very much alike on this as well, is that the problem is not that you have a lack of growth potential of AI, is that you may, in the same way as inappropriate competition policy ended up getting in the way of IT as a growth engine, in the same way, if you have the AI revolution and you don't reform competition policy, again, there will be an institutional obstacle to growth. And why is that a problem? Well, I told you already about that, okay? I don't want to go there three times. It's because if you look at the value chain of AI and the upstream segments in the value chain of AI, you see the cloud is dominated by three superstar firms, the same as before, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and you have only one big actor, GPU, on the market for graphic processes. And so what you need is a true competition policy. You need open source, you need some regulations, but not too many regulations, because you have too many regulations become an entry barrier. The large incumbents, they know how to cope with them, the small entrants don't. You need a Digital Market Act. You see that insist on data sharing to be extended to the whole value chain of AI. You need data access. You need all those things. And you need local computing centers. And I think that's, we need much more of that. But we have a competition problem in AI. So technologically speaking, I believe that AI has a big growth potential. The problem is that institutions may not adapt, in particular competition policy. So that's why I'm less optimistic. So I'm not a complete optimist. I am a guarded optimist, because I believe in the growth, in the technological potential, but institutions may not adapt, in particular competition policy. Employment is the same thing. If you look at employment, what's very interesting is that firms in France that adopted AI so far, they have created employment. They destroyed some employment, but if you look overall, they created employment. Why? Because they became more productive, more competitive, and therefore there was a bigger demand for their product, exactly like we did with Xavier Jaravel on robots. The firm become more productive, and therefore there is a higher world demand for their product, and that's, this productivity force in France so far has more than counteracted the substitution of manpower by AI. It's not uniform. There are sectors where you see that firms that adopt AI, sales go up, so you really have this productivity effect. Another reason why you could have job creation is that when you adopt AI, I told you, allows you to create many new ideas. You can recombine old ideas into new ideas. So that's also a channel whereby AI can create new jobs, but of course AI will also destroy jobs, obviously. And what you can show, so here you see that, for example, AI used for administrative purpose on highly exposed jobs and where most of the tasks can be substituted by AI, there the effect is no longer positive. Okay, so it's not uniformly positive. There will be some job creation and some job destruction. And in fact, if you look at the impact of AI on job turnover, wherever AI has been adopted, job turnover has gone up. It means that you have more job destruction and more job creation. Even though so far the job creation in France dominates, you have job creation and job destruction. What does that mean? And then I will end up with this. It means that you need to education and flex security. More than ever, you need good flex security system. But why is it that it works well in Denmark? Not only because they are smarter, they do good flex. They have a good education system. At school, when you have good schools, like the No Excuse Charter School in the US, you learn to learn. I think it's very important to have school with AI and school without AI. It's very important that children at school learn to learn. They can concentrate on problems. They concentrate on reading, on writing, on on computing, without AI. And they need to learn to learn. When you have a school where you learn to learn, they do the No Excuse Charter Schools do that a lot in the US. On top of it, you can have a good flex security system. And if you have the combination of a good education system that provides good PISA tests on writing, reading, and calculus, and on top of it, you put a good flex security, I think there you can harness the job creation potential of AI. You can do much better, you see. So again there, you see, institutions matter. You want to harness the growth potential of AI? Competition. You want to harness the job creation potential of AI? Good education and flex security system. So you remember, those were the three policies I emphasized before. I said, how can you become more innovative and more inclusive? I told you, flex security, education, competition. Those are the same policies that will allow countries to make the best use of AI. I believe that technological revolutions are like horses. They can take you to the wall, or they can lead you anywhere you want. And you have to guide, you have to steer the horse. And the institutions is exactly that. If you don't put the right policies and institutions, the technology can produce the worst outcome. But if you know how to harness, and that you do with appropriate policies and institutions, you can get a lot out of new technological revolutions. So at the end of the day, creative destruction can deliver sustained and inclusive growth and prosperity provided appropriate policies are put in place. And it's true also for AI. AI can deliver, can be one way whereby European growth can resume, but we need to have those same policies, you know, competition, education, flexibility in place to take the maximum advantage of the AI revolution. Well, I think I'm done. I think you are free now. Thank you so much.
Okay, I think we will catch our breath now, let you do the same. So we'll be opening the floor to questions. Just put your hand up, not yet. We'll bring a mic to you. Just say, you know, your name, affiliation, and ask one, hopefully short question so we can get to as many as possible. And I'll be going back and forth between questions here in the auditorium, and we have also an online audience. Okay, go.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
My name is Joella. I am LSE alumni and currently work for the EBRD. And so my question is that I fully believe that AI in 50 years is going to lead to amazing growth and lots of innovation. But what I am concerned about, and I'm sure many people in this room are concerned about, is what about in the next 3-5 years as we graduate or have recently graduated, since AI seems to be taking entry-level jobs, even if it's creating jobs, maybe in more middle management or higher up. So how would a government, or how can we, I guess, protect ourselves from becoming a lost generation to AI?
Yeah, so that's where I believe that it's important to have, government policies to make sure that you're either retrained or having a job or combination of the two, quoi. And that's what I think laissez-faire will not do it, quoi. That I think is very important. I also hope, governance will encourage firms to develop soft skills in firms. You see what I mean? So in firms, you have the hard skills and the soft skills. Soft skills are how you interact with others in the firm, how you direct, and I think to give more emphasis on the soft skills and to encourage polyvalence within firms so that, you know, firms will be encouraged to keep their workers, to train them, to develop the soft skills. And I think there are a number of things that can be done to make sure that, you are, alors, of course, a good schooling system, you become adaptable. When you learn to learn at school, you learn to adapt. So that's why I believe very much in the combination of good school, the flex security, and encouraging firms to also have flexibility within the firm. And I know that Danny Roderick and Stephanie Stancheva and others have thought about that part as well. And with Richard Blondel also, we did some, and Rachel Griffiths on soft skills. But I think there is something there to be done. You see what I mean? So to make sure that nobody is neither in training nor on the job. Quoi. Voilà, that I think is very important. And I think there is a way to. By the way, in some firms, I know firms have, some people say, well, a lot of jobs have been destroyed because of AI. I believe to some extent that AI was a pretext. I don't say it was only a pretext, but I think some firms took AI as a pretext, as they did with the financial crisis, to lay off, workers they wanted to lay off. So it would be very interesting to see how much layoff were truly due to AI and how many were just AI as a pretext. I think it would be very interesting to find out.
Oh, this is interesting. Nobody over here, huh? Okay, let's go over there. Yeah.
Hello, sir. My name is Raghav Harjai. I am an LSE student studying MSc Economics 2-year program. I'm in the first year. So, yeah. So my question is
better.
That, am I audible?
Yeah, that's much better.
Yeah. So this whole argument is based on the assumption that in the solo growth model, the A is representing the technological progress. But there are some economists who say that A represents actually institutional growth. For example, other institutions like geography or healthcare or other institutions. So what do you think, what is your take on the that perspective, and how do you think these institutions contribute to growth? Yeah.
So so I don't know, for example, I believe very much in good education, good health, you know, good health services. I believe, you know, that in the quality, you know, climate, I believe, you know, that there are a number of, there has been a debate there, which indicator should you use? So part of the no decline was to say, well, in fact, you should not look at per capita GDP at all. You should have something that combines this with inequality, with green and things. My way of looking at things is to say, you have various ways to look at the decline, is to say, well, we have per capita GDP going down relative to US. We see frontier innovation going down. We lose control of value chains. And the problem with that is that it's much harder for us to afford good health, good education, and other things which we believe to be important. You see what I mean? So one way is to say, don't merge everything. And the other one is to say, if we want to afford, we had a good social model. I mean, we could improve our social model. If we want to sustain our social model, we need to grow faster. We need to become more innovative. And so it's clearer this way. You see what I mean? By the way, I'm not obsessed with GDP growth. I believe in green growth. You see what I mean? I believe in quality growth. I believe in utils. There are many things that are not in GDP. You see, if we live much better in many respects than before, it's not captured by GDP. But I'm concerned with that at the end of the day. But you cannot totally do away with those indicators because they tell you something about your ability to finance things that you consider to be important for welfare. And that's, I think it's clearer than merge everything together. I think it's better that we acknowledge in Europe that we are lagging behind China and the US and now China, possibly in some areas, and then deal with it and say, well, this way we can afford to have a better social system. But I don't oppose, because I believe that you can boost innovation-based growth and various, you know, measures of well-being.
So let's take a question from online.
Would you like to take one question or a couple from online to consider, like two or three?
Well, I'll take that as a hint, so we'll take two.
Yes. Brilliant. Okay. Gregor Hopf, an LSE alumnus, asks if it's possible for companies to internalize creative destruction in order to stay innovative and maintain their dominance in market. Another question is whether we still are looking at a significant US-China rivalry, or whether like innovation is becoming a bit more multilateral internationally. And last question is whether the current US administration is an example of creative destruction.
Yeah, you'll join me on my next trip there, I can see that. Yeah, from beginning to end. Yeah. On the first question, should firm internalize? I mean, there is a whole debate on corporate social responsibility, for example. And there was a very interesting debate, because you start with Friedman, 1970. He says, you know, firms should just maximize profits and they should not worry about anything else. And it's up to governments to set up rules, and then subject to those rules, firms will maximize profits. It's very interesting, by the way, that the extreme left in France is very Friedmanian, because they think that if you start talking about corporate social responsibility, it's a way to disengage the state. So, in fact, very interestingly, in France, the extreme left is very Friedmanian. But we know that it doesn't fully work, because there are countries where, you know, first we know that incumbent firms will put pressure on governments to prevent, you know, competition, but also to circumvent a number of rules that you should have. There are countries where we are very mindful of the environment, but then there are other countries we don't have any control and they become pollution heavens. So when you are in a world like that, those were very, very interesting papers by Benabou and Tirole criticizing, showing the limits of freedom. 1970. So is that the question you had? I mean, was it related? Is it a way to get to intersect with your question, the debate on Friedman, the pro and Friedman versus Benabou Tirole? Yeah. Then you asked about China, that is given to China and the US. So I think it's interesting to see, I think it's interesting for Europe to see that now we are being leapfrogged by China in some areas. Because you see, some of my colleagues believe first that China had no hope of ever taking off.
No name there, okay? I love them, they're my co-star, my friend. They think they will not even take off. Then they managed to grow. Then they said they will get into the middle income trap for sure. It's not even an epsilon probability they wouldn't. But you can see now in solar panels, in face recognition, a number of technology, and I showed you, you know, China is booming now. So, I don't know if they will become Kunian innovators. That I don't know. Maybe there you need really freedom that they don't have. That's a big question. But they are pretty good. They're already, you know, frontier innovators on a number of technologies, unlike the previous predictions. So it's very interesting for Europe. So, you know, now we are facing, you know, two frontier innovators. And they had in common the fact that they understood that you need competition, as I mentioned, but you should not preclude smart industrial policy in the name of competition policy. They had both in China, and they had both in the US. And in Europe, we had this rule, a very Hayekian view, with all my respect for Hayek, a very Hayekian rule that in the name of competition policy in Europe, we should preclude any form of industrial policy, any form of sectoral setup. And we see where we are now. Now we are there, France getting together with UK, maybe with Germany, saying, let's do a DARPA. Let's do our own DARPA. But we do that 25 years too late. Do you see what I mean? Because we were very dogmatic. You see, we said the budget deficit limited to 3%. We put the same footing in the same basket. We put, pension policy and investment in growth. That was wrong. In the name of competition policy, we preclude industrial policy. We became a regulatory giant and a budgetary dwarf. So, for example, when Macron tried to say, let's have euro bonds, in Germany, some people say yes, some people say no. We'll see what happens. We are way behind, you see. And that's where I think it was good. So Davos was very interesting. Because Davos, everybody rushed into listening to Trump. And Trump slapped the face of the European, flack, 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 like this. He was saying things that were right. He said, you've been very bad. I can't say he was wrong in that respect. And the Chinese, they were there, you know, as spectators. That was Davos. It was very interesting, the Davos this year. But they were not saying that we were lagging behind. That's true. So it's important to say, do we want to play a role? You saw the picture where I showed Europe falling down. Do we want to reverse trend? And we can. We have talents. I showed you on the research. We have fantastic researchers in Europe. Yann LeCun, you know, was at Meta. The head of Meta is coming to France and England to develop what he believes will be the next revolution in AI after following the large language models. So there is promise in Europe. We have, also values. We have a social model, democracy and freedom. Europe has a lot to offer. But so we have soft power. We can harness this soft power. And the question is, shall we get our acts together and wake up? So I think that's where we are. So I think it's good. It's a good, to be in between China and the US and say, do we want to exist between them or not? I think it's a good wake-up call.
So let's go into the middle right there down here.
I can see you are dead.
Hi, my name is Donya. I'm a student here at LSE as well.
I don't see you. Can you?
Hello.
Okay.
I was wondering if you could touch a little bit on the environmental boundaries
absolutely.
Of this theory.
Absolutely.
Because I would assume over the medium to long term, you'll get to a point where there's less innovations where the social cost benefit analysis still makes sense. So what do you think is like the limit of this theory and at what point do you expect we'll get there?
You're right. I mean, and Nick is here and the thing is that I had limited time and I should maybe have devoted a lot to green. There is a whole debate on the degrowth, okay? And we know historically, there is the Madison curve. You've seen Madison, huh? Madison tried to reconstitute world GDP since Jesus Christ or whatever. And you see it's a flat up to 1820. And growth, as we know it now, is 200 years old, which is terrible because it's less than three times my age. That's when you think about it, that's quite a boo. So growth is a very recent phenomenon. And when you look at the temperature curve, it's really parallel to the, it's exactly replicating the GDP curve. You see it? I mean, so if you look at those two curves, you think that, global warming has everything to do with growth. I mean, I can believe that. I believe that. Now, from there, you have those who say the way out is degrowth. But you know what degrowth, so what I say in Paris, Paris, we have the 5th and the 6th arrondissement of Paris. We call them bourgeois bohème, bobo. And I say that the degrowth is a bobo thing in Paris, quoi. Because if you are in a developing country, you know what it means to have degrowth. It means famines and poverty, quoi. So c'est un truc de bobo, quoi. But that's, I don't know why you would say that in here. So my way out, says to say the way is green innovation. And by green innovation, what do we mean? We mean innovation in our behavior. Of course, we have to behave differently. Maybe we don't turn on all the lights at home. Maybe we don't fly every day. Maybe we. That's innovation. Innovation in our behavior. That degrowth, people would agree. The other thing is that we have to. There is innovations for mitigation to slow down the rise in temperature, new source of energy, producing with less energy. Those are mitigation. Then you have the adaptation innovation, new air conditioning system, new dikes that will become increasingly important. And there are people who work on amelioration. I remember, a few years back, Robin, you remember, you invited this guy from the Harvard Physics Department. I forgot his name. And he was talking about geoengineering. And he said, well, you know, you have a way to cool down the air with reproducing what happens after volcano eruption. Well, some people work on technologies to cool down the air. I don't know what will happen with those things. But there is green innovation. The problem is that firms don't spontaneously innovate green. Firms that used to innovate dirty, they tend spontaneously to continue innovating in dirty. We call that path dependence in the direction of technical change. And therefore, there is a role for government to redirect firms' technical change towards green technologies. And you do that through combination of carrot and stick. So carbon tax, carbon price is very important, but you need also green industrial policy. A problem I think we had in Europe, and then, of course, it's very intimidating to be in front of Robin and Nick, I'm sure they will, is that in the US you had the feeling they did a lot of green industrial policy. Now, of course, they are. But they did some, IRA and others, they had the ARPA energy. They did, in China, they did green industrial policy. They do green industrial policy. And in Europe, we concentrated on carbon tax and carbon price, and we did not do enough of green industrial policy. I believe we need both. If you only do carbon price without green industrial policy, you know what you get, the yellow vest in France. That's exactly what happened. We raised the gasoil price, but the people living in remote suburbs, they didn't have any alternatives. They didn't have, you know, S-bans or trams, and therefore they revolted. Of course, they were right to revolt. So we need to have that combination. But you see, that's, so there is a role for government, you know, carbon price, green industrial policy, also the civil society. We know that consumers can also impact enormously on the direction of technical progress. So there is this whole other part. But it's again the same theme that means that innovation, firms innovate, but you need governments and civil society to steer innovation in the right direction, you see. And I think the hope is to have that. I mean, I don't see how we can do without a mixture, you know, without having all these policies there to and having governments who are there to push firms to innovate in those, in all those dimensions in particular that I mentioned. But there is a whole part. But see, again, the same theme. On the technology, I'm optimistic. Is where I'm not optimistic is on the policies and institutions and the political economy of it. And it's exactly the same basic theme. A bit long answer to a short question. Right. I mean, I'm sure that Nick will have a lot. I refer to Robin, Nick, and my friends. They have much, much more to say on this.
Hi. Aloysius Lipp from UCL. I saw two really striking pieces of news on UK dynamism recently. So the first is that on real-term indicators measures, labour productivity is finally rising, and they think that some of that is from low productivity employees exiting those firms. Maybe that's driving that. And then the second, maybe labour productivity is finally rising because low productivity firms have their employees exiting. And then secondly, there was BCG report out yesterday which suggested that the long tail of firms in the UK is larger than it's ever been. So I wonder, is your reading of all of the latest news that the UK is in a good place to ride a new wave of creative destruction, or do you think we need a bit more of a policy push to take the latest market turbulence into some good reallocation?
Well, I mean, I'm not on top, you know, on UK, so I'd be very, very cautious because I don't want to fall into the... There is an illness when you get that you start talking about things you don't know much. So I want to try and minimize the risk. I think the UK, you know, for example, what I can tell you is that a very good positive sign in the UK, from, seen from the French perspective, is that now we have a UK who want to work with us. So when I mentioned the DARPA, for example, the Defence Advanced Project Agency, or the ARPA, you see, more generally, on defence AI, on green, on the UK want to work with us, with France. And I think that's great. That's new. That's well, it's very much this government. So I think I'm very hopeful. And you know, the UK, that you are, they have enormous strengths, you know, in defence, in biotech, in they are very, you know, universities are first rate. You know, you have, and so whatever other European countries can do to work with the UK would be very important. I think you know, when it comes to defence and AI and all that, I mean, seen for, you know, we are back to 1945, or we are back to the, you know, it was, it's with the UK that we can do it. So I think UK is a pillar of Europe, truly. And I think that now there is, the government, I feel, we see from the rest of Europe that the UK, they are very much out into innovation, into, you know, joining forces to become more independent on technology, on defense, on AI, on, and I think that's, and given that, you know, you have fantastic research base, I'm very hopeful. I think that's one of the good news of the past years.
Take one more question online, and then we'll do one more from the audience.
Okay, the last question from on the line is from anonymous viewer again, but it's asking whether you think the EU, for example, has strong enough policies in place to be able to retrain employees during the AI transition.
So it's the EU?
Yes.
The EU itself, quoi?
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if I will respond. I will not fully respond. I will use your question to answer another question, probably. I will tell you, EU ERC was a good success. I think the European Research Council, I think that's good. I'm very happy because they secured ERC financing for the next years, quoi, because there was a danger that they would undo ERC. Quoi. I know Maria Lepkin, who is the head of ERC, was very worried that they would undo ERC. And I think at least there is secured ERC. I would have liked ERC to be expanded for, you know, to finance labs, for example, for 10-year periods. So I would like, me personally, an extended ERC that would not only finance for 5 years, but would finance lab for 10-year period. I told you about the importance of long-term research finance funding. Now, the other policies, you know, I mentioned to you single market, I mentioned to you institutional investors, the DARPA. I think those, I believe, in the coalition of the willing. So we are back to France, UK. I believe, very smart, funny, I mean, we may be able to do much more France and the UK, probably with Germany or that, than France with Hungary or with many other countries that are in the EU. I think most of the if we are to implement the recommendation of the Draghi report that I mentioned, I believe much more into coalition of the willing. And we should align on the max and not on the mean. So when you say EU, you know, I don't, maybe for research there I can see EU. Quoi. For the rest, for the moment, I don't quite see it, quoi, at EU level. Quoi. I don't believe in federalism, for example. I know that some of my colleagues are very strong on European federalism. I think c'est une, lubie, quoi, in French we would say. I don't believe in it. I believe in coalition of the willing. I believe in states that they decide or not to do things together. I think that's the way.
Okay, so let's we'll take one more question, and then let's go right down there. All right, well, that's also okay. That's fine. Go ahead.
Okay. Cheers. Hi, I'm Tim, unaffiliated. I have a question around, you spoke about how the innovation rents enable businesses to grow to a larger size, and then and the negative side, they can use that to suppress smaller competitors growing up, and we're sort of seeing that, I think, a little bit in the US, sort of large tech buying up SMEs quite a lot. Have you seen any examples of good policy mechanisms that have enabled innovation at the smaller end of firms without necessarily stifling innovation at the larger end?
Yeah, so it's interesting that in the US, despite the fact that currently competition policy is not at its best, and that maybe more than in the past, you have collusion between some large firms and government. there is a big danger of cronyism. I mean, not only, we also have collusion in France and in other countries. I don't want again to... yet the fact that you have this financial ecosystem that works so well made it possible for new firms to come in. So it's true, on the competition side, it could work much better. But they seem to have made up partly by the fact of having this fantastic financial ecosystem that we lack in the... Very interestingly, on the financial ecosystem, Sweden is a very interesting example. Despite the fact they don't have a fully funded pension system, they managed to develop pension funds a lot. They had a very smart policies to develop institutional investors. It's a very interesting example. I could say those are small countries. But Sweden is an interesting country. You can see the social mobility and the innovativeness there. And a lot through, I think, the financial ecosystem that they developed. So some teams that don't work optimally, but it may be compensated by other things that work. And of course, you would ideally like all of them to work together. But sometimes, even if you don't have a right away the competition policy you would dream of, having a good financial ecosystem can already help small firms enter and grow.
So thank you. Before we say thank you, someone slipped me a note and said, give a gentle reminder. I'm not quite sure why it needs to be gentle. There's a reception outside for drinks that you are all invited to stay, and we can continue the conversation out there. So with that, please, let's thank you so much for a wonderful
thank you.
Subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.